Good afternoon, everyone. This is the regular speaker meeting held at the AA picnic. We'll take a time out on the volleyball court. Thank you very much. Charlie told me today he was going to get two microphones up here because he found out I had a split personality. I don't understand what he means. Neither does the other side. I'd like to open this meeting with a moment of silence, followed by the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. My name is Bob, and I am an alcoholic. You know, it's wonderful to see so many people at an AA function. I can remember when the... This will try your patience, won't it? You'll find out what's going on with me with this noise behind me. I was fortunate enough to sober up in this park. And the AA picnic started here 17 years ago. At the first AA picnic, we thought we were fortunate because we had 450 people. And you look at now and what this great fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, you look around, you see about 3,000 people here, all sober, all enjoying a good afternoon. Yeah, that's right. I think we all know where we'd be without each other. I like to look at Alcoholics Anonymous as a chain of weak links. Together we can make something true, wonderful, and great. We can share our experience, strength, and hope with each other. And we can keep this program going as long as we want to keep it going. We need not fear the outside taking over. It's the inside rotting out. So be good to each other and love each other. And with that, we'll start the meeting. At this point, I'd like to introduce John C. from Los Gatos. Let's give John a welcome.
My name is John, and I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank all of the people who invited me here while they still are not displeased for doing the same. And this is an experience. I was leaving my house. My wife decided that she didn't want to come. And she said, honey, she likes me now. She said, honey, knock them dead. You better be good. And I said to her, if I'm going to drive all the way across this valley and pay $5 to hear me talk, I goddamn well better be good. The other night I was in an AA meeting, which is usually where I prefer to be. And a young man who was relatively new to the fellowship, he said, are you the John C. that is speaking down at the Hidden Valley Ranch? And I said, with all the modesty I'm capable of, I said, yes. And he said, how do you prepare for that? And I thought about that, and I thought, Jesus, is there enough time for me to go out and get drunk and really get a good story? Fortunately, sanity has been restored. Most of the time. I failed to qualify myself, and it's kind of important to say that I am also a member of the Saturday Night Live group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we're wild, and we absolutely insist on enjoying life. And I am the token old man in that group. Yeah! Right on. I walked into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous without any of the knowledge that I have here currently. And I want to tell you that even though I thought that night sucked, I really thought you guys were just disgusting. You offered to share intimate things that I wouldn't even share with my wife. You laughed at inappropriate times, and you didn't have the proper amount of respect for a man of my caliber. And I really thought it was wrong to be that way. I went home, and that night I bought a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was really disgusted. And I shared with my wife what had happened and the things that had happened. And we sat in the and talked in my garage for a long time about this thing. And I admitted to the fact that I was an alcoholic. I did not know what alcoholic meant at that time. An alcoholic, once ingesting alcohol, creates the phenomenon of craving. I did not know that I had lost the power to control my drinking. I didn't know that. All I knew is that the people were there, they told stories, their lives were similar to mine, and I figured that, well, that's a big deal. If you be alcoholic to belong to this outfit, I'll admit to it. My wife, the stupid broad that she was, she figured that because I knew that, I was never going to drink again. I hadn't made that decision. But what I did do is I opened up the big book and I read it, and I studied it, and I studied it, and I studied it, and I took all the 12 steps. And then I went to my second meeting. I honestly will have to tell you that from that first night to this, my life has changed. And it has changed for the better. I heard a man tell me in an AA meeting a number of years ago that really struck the chords of my heart. And it was basically my story. And I vowed that it would not be my story in sobriety. The story he told me was, I had a good day yesterday, but I didn't know it until today. And that was me. It is like the greatest, I now come to find out that the greatest single moment of my entire life occurred when I walked into the St. Luke's meeting on a Tuesday and listened to you and went home and declared that I was an alcoholic. That was the greatest single moment of my entire life. I didn't know it then, but I know it now. I shall be eternally grateful to the fellowship. And the reason I say that is perhaps my story is no different than yours, but it's my story. It's the only one I have. You see, I did not know enough to reach out and find you. I had been out there drinking and using for over 30 years. Well, 30 years, give or take a day. I had been drinking and using. And I didn't know the problem. I did not know the depth of the problem. But the love of Alcoholics Anonymous, the great love of Alcoholics Anonymous, was so intense that it reached out and brought me to you. And when I was incapable of finding you, and I was almost incapable of recognizing you when I got here, I came so close to leaving because in my mind I hadn't done those things. I hadn't done what you had done, and I had been paying attention to the differences rather than the similarities. Because it says that there's a line in our big book that talks about, despite all we can say, many who are real alcoholics are going to figure they're not in that class. And the line that is so key to me is that by every form of self-deception and experimentation, we'll try to prove ourselves exception to the rule, therefore non-alcoholic. Now, I stayed here because you offered me a way of life that was so outstanding that if you were not the biggest liars I've ever met in my life, and if what was happening in your life was true, then you had what it was that I had been looking for all my life. You see, I have always known that drinking was never my problem. Life was. I know that the alcohol that I ingested was the only means by which I could stay in the society that I was born into. I was born into a rotten world that I didn't fit into. I had to go out there and eke out a miserable living in a hostile universe with people whose mannerisms and deportment sucked. And I wanted no part of that. I did the very best I could to isolate myself from that. And that's one of the dichotomies or one of the fascinating things about the alcohol, the alcoholic, and how it is that he can deceive himself. I tried every form I knew to be a total loner. I did not like people. I did not like society. I didn't like anything. I knew I was maladjusted to life. But in the process of doing that, I married my first wife, and we had five little girls. When I first met her, she was in my high school sweetheart, and we got married. And I was a wild, woolly, raisin' hell, drinking, two-fisted, crazy son of a bitch. And just the only way I knew it, I had been given an incredible gift of fighting, and I fought everybody and everything, and up to... Oh, God, I'm glad it didn't fulfill itself, but up to until the day I got sober, I used to comment, but I've never met the man I couldn't whip. Oh, Jesus, I am so grateful that I didn't offer that in an AA meeting. I'm too little to live. But when I met my wife and we got married, even though I didn't want to get married, she presented me with a little girl. And one of the things, and this is kind of where I'm talking about it, the feeling of managing my own life, is that I realized that I could not do what it was that I was doing. And I decided that I'd have to take care of my children. And so I quit the wildness. I got a job. And I tried to be the best father of my children that I could be. We were blessed with a total of five little girls. And I was on a running block out one time. And I woke up from this blackout and I was on the telephone. And they told me that my wife had just committed suicide. And the next thing I know that there's a whole bunch of people there trying to put me in a straitjacket. And then the next thing I know, I'm in the psychiatric wing of the Los Angeles General Hospital and I'm laying on this table. And they're discussing whether it's permissible and safe to let me go because they had to sew me up because I'm cut up quite a bit and they need to sew me together. And they're talking about what a crazy son of a bitch he is that it's not safe to let him go. And what I want to share with you is a feeling that I had then. And the feeling that I had was unbelievable power. That if you let me go, let me get out of this thing, I'll go out there and I'll get my little girls and I'll take care of them like only I can take care of them. Just let me out of this goddamn thing. And then the next thing I know, I'm all laying on another bed and I'm strapped into bed and I'm all sewed up. And I got this same feeling that I got to get loose. I got to go out and take care of my little girls. And then I started to do what is necessary to do. And I was I was laying in there with a couple other people and they knew I was weird and I knew they were weird because we were all both in the same nut house. But they were concerned about me because I was all bloody and I had a whole bunch of crap around me and I was in a straitjacket and they weren't. And I started to, and I wound up getting myself loose from this thing. And I got up and then I realized the hopelessness and the futility of my existence, that there was nothing that I could do that would rectify this horrendous thing that I had done, nor was there anything I could do for my children. But being a typical alcoholic, I conned myself out of that place after a relatively short period of time, looked around the world and realized that my whole problem was Southern California, and I came to Northern California. I brought my children up with me, and I became the best father and husband that you'd ever want to know. And there's a lot of ladies here, and I want to tell you something, that I was a person who took great pride in the fact that I couldn't boil water without burning it. And I suddenly became a mother and father of five little kids. As most alcoholics, we learn to adapt and do it damn well. I learned how to cook and iron. Now, you can tell from my physical age, if I'm talking about little kids, because the two of those little rats were in diapers at the time, is that in those days, that was before wash and wear. And they had these pretty frilly dresses with puff sleeves and laces all the way down. Yeah, like your wedding dress. And I had one of my oldest daughter was 10 at the time. And she had the prettiest dress I have ever seen in my life. It was brown, and it had a big lace yoke, puff sleeves, and lace ribbons all the way down. Just a peasant-type dress. And it was just gorgeous. And I was sitting there one night with my Jack Daniels, and I was ironing because the kids were in bed. That's the only time I could do it. And I remember scorching this thing. I scorched this lace, and God, I didn't have that much money, and I had destroyed my daughter's precious dress. And so for the next 2.5 hours and the rest of the bottle of Jack Daniels, I went ahead and scorched the rest of the lace to match. And she had the prettiest brown dress you had ever known. But I was in total command of my life, and I knew it. Unfortunately, I then met a lady who is now my wife. She had a boy and a girl in a car and a television set and enough money to buy me a wedding ring. And it was an opportunity that was too great to pass up. I looked at her and I told her, I said, honey. No, I didn't say that. I said, bitch. I always want to say honey, but I didn't. And I said, baby. I said, baby, stick with me. And I'll show you places you've never seen. And I'll take you places you've never gone. And by God, we'll do things you have never done. Possibly the most honest statement I've ever made in my entire life. On the 30th of July past, that lady and I celebrated our 28th wedding anniversary. And it's only by the grace of this fellowship that came to pass. I know that there's a lot of people out there that know my story, and it's the only one I've got, and they're going to say, oh, Christ, now he's going to go on, and my house purrs. And it does. My wife has participated in my sobriety from the moment I got sober. I walked in and told her I was an alcoholic, and we discussed it. And I started sharing with her because I was a bashful, shy, timid sort of person, and I'll be damned if I was going to share anything with you because you were the professionals. She was the amateur, and I could go home and be a professional to her. And so I'm teaching her recovery, and she's absorbing it. And it's kind of disgusting because she seemed to be an awful lot weller than I. And amazing things happened in my life, and it still is happening, and I'll share some of those amazing things. Because the first thing I did is I started studying the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. In true fact, I did. I became obsessed with recovery. I did nothing but study the Big Book, listen to the tapes of a magnificent speaker whom I refer to as my mentor, my teacher, Chuck C., for those of you who would like to know that, one of the greatest men that I have ever known in my life, has had more impact upon me than anyone else on the face of this earth. I was just lost in this thing. And I was going to meetings, I was 12-stepping, and I was carrying the message to anybody and everybody. It didn't make any difference whether they wanted to hear it or not. By God, I was going to save sobriety for the world. And I come rushing home one day, and I told Peggy, I said, my God, Peg, I got this funny feeling. And she said, what do you mean you got a funny feeling? I said, I got a funny feeling, it's in my gut, and I don't know what it is. And she said, well, what kind of a feeling is it? I said, I don't know, I've never felt it before. And she said, well, is it good or bad? And I said, well, God, it's good, but gee, I don't have anything to feel good about. And she said, well, if you were going to call it, what would you call it? And I said, well, impending good. I am suffering from impending good, and I have from that moment to this. Sometimes it's been better than others, but I've always had it. I know, because you've taught me that it will get better. I was sitting I was 4 months sober, and I was in San Diego. And I was at a bowling tournament, state tournament down in San Diego. And we went out to dinner, and I was caught in this saloon. I was there for 2.5 hours. And I absolutely went crazy. It was the toughest single moment of my entire life. I went through more pain and agony at that point because they talk about the veil of honesty or the veil of secrecy had been lifted from me. I was not full of self-deception. The truth was mine. I suddenly now realized why it was that my children had left me. I know now why it was that my children, whom I loved so dearly and I tried so dreadfully hard to be good to, why they had cut and run. I knew it. That particular day, and this is one of the first miracles that occurred in my life, You see, I'm starting to play with a chain, and this particular day my wife bought me this chain, and I was caught in this place and I was going crazy. And this is my first spiritual experience that I know of in sobriety. Because I was there holding this chain, because if I ever got my hands loose, I was going to kill somebody. I wanted to drink. I wanted to rip. I wanted to roar. I wanted so desperately to get rid of these god-awful feelings, these crazy thoughts that were coming in my head that gave me no defense for all of the things that I had done. I knew full well what it was and who had done the things that had been done. And there was no more justification from the blackouts. Coming in or rolling off a blackout and seeing the rack and the ruin. And I knew who was responsible for that, and it just damn near killed me. And I held on to this chain for everything I was worth. You know, and I say it's my first great spiritual experience, and because this particular chain is a very cheap chain. You know, it's kind of like Alcoholics Anonymous. It doesn't cost much. But this chain is just like Alcoholics Anonymous. It doesn't have a weak link in it. Had the chain broke, I don't know what I would have done. But I probably would have done what I have done before. I would have done the things that was necessary to ease the pain. I would have done those things that I felt that I could do and get by with. I came back to Northern California. I got lost in sobriety. I have been lost in it ever since. Another story that I like to tell, because it is a special one, is that when I got sober, I had many things of possessions. I had two cars. I had just built a new house in Los Gatos. I had more money in the bank than I had ever had, and I was terrified I was going to lose it all, as I always have. I worked my fanny off to get a lot of money, because that's the only security that I knew, and then I would lose it. And I knew full well at the time I got sober, I was going to lose it all. And so when I got sober, I had this house, and it's the first home that Peggy had ever had, and it had a brand new home. And if you've ever bought a new home, you know what happens when the builder plants the lawn. You know, they plant weeds. That's what they do. It's deliberate. It's part of the plot that I came from, that they're out to get you all the time. And builders do that just to test your mettle and find out if you're really going to stay. And I think that's one of the reasons why so many people sell homes after they buy them. They just move along because of the weeds in the lawn. And Peggy and I were out there pulling those weeds, and I got sober and I got infinitely too spiritual to screw around with a lousy lawn. And I'd come home and she'd be sweating her little fanny off and pulling weeds out of that dumb old lawn. And one evening I came home to her, and she was standing there, and she was standing there with this funny look on her face. She said, "Well, I give up." I said, "Honey, what'd you give up on?" She said, "I gave up on the lawn." I said, "Good. Let's pour concrete in it, paint it green, and everything will be cool, and I can get about my doing God's business." And she said, "Well, that's what I did." And I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "I turned the lawn over to God." And I looked at her, and this woman is crazy. I said, "You can't do that." She says, "I don't care, I did." And I have married a weird woman. And so every night I'd come home, whenever it was daylight, I'd look at that lawn. I didn't see any change in the lawn. But I'm a little bit suspicious, because this is kind of a program where you expect a miracle. Because already my life has changed dramatically. Amazing things have happened to me. My feeling good all of the time. And then I forgot about the lawn. And I came home one night, and I came home one night, and it was early, and I looked at the lawn, and I said, "Oh my God." I run into the house, and I said, "Peg, did you see what's happened to our lawn?" And she smiled, that shitty smile, and said, "Yes, dear." And I said, "God's lawn." And one of the interesting things that I found out, because of the honesty that has developed on that, my spiritual experience and my spiritual awakening may not be yours. But that does not reduce the quality of the spiritual awakening that anyone in this room has had, or anyone in this place has had. When you stop to realize it, and this is one of the things that I wanted to talk about, when you stop to realize that Alcoholics Anonymous was founded by a drunk laying in a bed, who said, "If there be a God, reveal himself to me," and the room was full of blinding flashlight, and he felt better. Hell, that happened to me a lot of times. But I never thought it was a spiritual awakening. But it was for him, and I will not deny it. You see, that's what's so vitally important. I have been told and taught by my teacher to never depreciate my own sobriety, because it is a valued good gift. And as I do not apologize for anyone as to my belief in God, nor do I apologize to anyone relative to my sobriety. It's the best goddamn sobriety I'm capable of attaining, one day at a time, and I know that, as do you. Because one of the things that are so funny about people, and I think it's funny about people, is that I discovered an amazing piece of information that I would share with you. It is amazing to me. We're talking about self-deception. I'm talking about this is a program which means that in order for me to stay here, I must grasp and develop a manner of living demanding rigorous honesty. Honesty, I looked at one of the finest definitions that I have ever received on honesty was a statement that honesty is freedom from self-deception. And I took that piece of information and I started looking at it and recognizing it had nothing to do necessarily with lying, cheating, stealing, or anything like that. It had a great deal to know about me, concealing from me things that I need to know. And I was driving my car one day, and a piece of information that came up to me is that I didn't have a seatbelt on. And I thought about why I didn't have the seatbelt on, and I realized that I didn't want to wear that seatbelt because I didn't want you to know I was wearing a seatbelt. You see, I was driving down the road, and I'd look at other cars and the people wearing seatbelts, and I'd say to myself, look at them, lame. I don't want them looking at me, saying, there's a wimp wearing a seatbelt. So I found out that that's why I didn't wear a seatbelt, so I tried to fix it. I strided to wear a seatbelt, and it didn't work. I had an opportunity once around that time to speak in Fresno, or not in Fresno, up in Redding. And on the way up there, I was listening to some AA tapes, and this speaker told me a story that fit right in with my discovery of honesty and self-deception. And what he told me is this. He told me a story that I would share with you. It's not a funny story. It's kind of an ugly story. Because I was telling it for a while, and I was expecting somebody to laugh, but nobody does. So it's not a funny story. I think it's an ugly story. But this is a story about three drunks, or three people sitting in a hotel room, in a coffee shop, and on a convention. And you know what happens on a convention with three normal people? They're out there raising hell. They're out of town just raising hell. And they were trying to figure out why all three people were sitting in this coffee shop on a Saturday night when everybody else should be out there playing games. So they looked at they're talking to each other, and one guy says, how come you're not out there chasing women and drinking booze? And the guy said, I just had a heart attack, and the doctor told me that I should take it easy. And as a matter of fact, I shouldn't really be drinking this coffee. And I'm going to finish this cup, and then I'm going to go to bed like the doctor told me. And the other two guys said, well, hell, there's nothing wrong with that. That's logical. That makes sense to us. They turned to the second guy, and he said, how come you are here on Saturday night? The second guy said, well, I'll tell you. I just found out that I'm an alcoholic. And alcoholics can't drink, and I'm too new in sobriety. And they say, don't go to slippery places if you don't want to slip. And I don't want to get drunk, and so I'm staying here. I'm going to finish my coffee and maybe have 16 more cups and a couple packs of cigarettes, and then I'm going to go to bed. And the other two guys thought, well, hell, that's reasonable. And they turned to this third guy and said, okay, now, what are you doing here? And this guy said, well, I always do the right thing. And why is it that I told a story and you heard it, and I don't think there's a person in this room that likes the guy who always does the right thing? He is a wimp. And then I started thinking about the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And then I started thinking about the 12 by 12. And then I look at that line in chapter 6 on our sixth step. And it says, most of us are willing to settle for just enough perfection as is necessary to get by in life, according to our perception of what's necessary to get by in life. And I suddenly realized I'm in a crazy outfit. I know Alcoholics Anonymous is just absolutely magnificently nuts. It is absolutely grand. It's glorious. We just raise more hell. But one of the funny things about the drunks of the world is I can stand up here in front of you and I can tell you, no, I'm really a bad man and these are the rotten, filthy things I've done. And I'm going to really be honest with you. These are the horrifying things that I've done. Everybody's going to be out there and they're going to say, right on, right on, me too, right on, right on. Everybody's going to enjoy it. Some simple shit walks up here and says, well, I put the plug in a jug and my life turned beautiful and I've never had a problem since. And you're on, and we all say the same thing, you phony son of a bitch. And I find that my understanding is that most of us want to be good. There's not a question in my mind, but most of us want to be good. Not only does most of us want to be good, most of us are in a program of Alcoholics Anonymous where the intent of it because is that we become a better human being. One of the self-deception rules that I find, the great self-deception that it is in here, is that I have a war going on between me. I don't mind being good, but I don't want you to know that. Well, I want you to know that, but I only want you to know what I tell you about. What I really would prefer, I don't mind being good if you find out that I'm good, but you don't know that I know that I'm good. And I say, oh, this is crazy. I no longer have to apologize for my sobriety to you. Nor do you have to apologize for the quality of your sobriety to anyone else. But this is a program that provides a vehicle by which we can live free. Free. One of the greatest things that I think is written in the big book of the one that appealed to me more than anything else when they told me, John, you can be free at last. You will owe no one anything. And I believe that with all my heart and soul. And I perhaps believe it more than anyone else. And I tell a story relative to that because we have a wedding calling. And I'm going to save some of you. We have a wedding coming up. And so I don't get to talk very much longer. And that's just too bad for me. But the freedom that I want to talk about is one of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says that we will know a new freedom. And I looked at the word new and I realized that my God, if it be new, it be bright, it be shiny, it be untarnished, it never has been known by me before, it's new. And if it be new and it's mine, I want it. It is available to me. You told me that the ghosts of my past that were nagging at me and ripping my heart out, that kept me up night after night, that I had to drink and drink and drink into insensibility to avoid feeling those crazy goddamn things going in, that god-awful feeling that only an alcoholic seems to know when you're laying there or standing there and your very being wants to explode because you can't stand the goddamn thing. And it doesn't make any difference what it is. It's just is too much and you can't stand it. God, I wanted freedom from that. And you told me I could have that. You told me and promised me that not only could I have it, it was mine if I did certain simple things. And as the result of that, and your involvement with me, and allowing me to come back, I started to do these things. I started them to the very best of my ability, and I'm still doing it today. And as the result of that, I've never had it so good. This is the only good life I have ever known, and the only easy life that has ever been mine, despite all of the hurdles that has come up since I got sober. And perhaps many more than I had before I got drunk. One of the hurdles I would talk about that I told you, and maybe most of you didn't believe it, but I told you that I know freedom as few men do. And I will share with you why it is that I can tell you that story, or why it is that I can make that statement. It's just simply this. And it has to do with prayer, because I share everything I've got with the God of my understanding. I share the good and I share the bad. And if I'm upset, I talk to God and I explain to Him what a miserable thing this is and it shouldn't happen to these beautiful people because I am dreadfully concerned about that. And I came to the awareness that that it was time for me to stop smoking. Now, I've smoked for a long time. I had 35 years of good smoking, and I had 4 years of grubby smoking. And they said, and I said, I'm going to quit smoking. And they said, well, all you have to do is become willing. And I said, well, I'm in trouble because I'm not willing. And they said, well, pray for willingness. And I said, look it. When I got here, I knew that there was only one hurdle. There was only one hurdle that stood between me and sobriety, and that's finding God as I understand God. And you told me I had to pray, and I said I didn't want to. And they said, you have to become willing to pray. And I said I didn't want to. And they said, you have to become willing to pray. And I said, I didn't want to. And they said that you become willing to become willing to become willing to pray, to learn how to pray. And I thought I was safe enough. And so I did that, and I immediately went out and started practicing praying. So you weren't going to trap me again because I wasn't willing, and I wasn't going to ask God, as I understand God, to give me willingness. When I knew damn well I wasn't willing, I wouldn't accept it, and I would have thrown it away. I don't believe in frivolous prayer. I ask God for exactly what I expect to get. And I'm not going to ask him for something I'm not willing to take when it's given to me because I'm a stubborn alcoholic. So I refused to deal with willingness. And so I thought about it for a while, as I do most of the prayers, because I absolutely believe that every serious thought is a prayer. And so I came up with what I consider to be the absolutely perfect prayer to solve my dilemma. Because it's time for me to stop smoking. And so I went to the God of my understanding. I said, hey, Father, I got a little problem here, and I'm not willing, and I'm not going to ask for it. But you can do for me what I can't do for myself, and I really would appreciate it if you'd make it difficult for me to continue to smoke. Now, I'm perfectly satisfied with that particular prayer, because it exercised and explained everything that I believe in. Make it difficult for me to smoke. I don't like the way you're running it, so just make it difficult for me, and I'll take care of it from there on in. Because I also believe, as I was taught, that the only hope of long-lasting sobriety is for me to establish a perfectly satisfactory relationship with a living God. A God, as I understand God, satisfactory to me, doesn't mean that I agree with it, but it nevertheless means it is satisfactory to me. This was a satisfactory prayer. I went to him and I told him, make it difficult for me to continue to smoke. I was in my office and I got a phone call the next day. The very next day, I got a phone call from a man on the program, and he said, oh my God, John. He says, I just woke up in a bar. He said, last thing I knew, it was a Saturday night. I was at the Saturday Night Live meeting, and I just went into a blackout. And I just woke up in a bar. I said, are you drinking? He said, I don't know. I had a mouthful of booze when I woke up, and I spit it out. I said, Jesus Christ, this guy's 3 months sober. I said, God, yo, I'll come get you. He said, no, that's all right. I'm okay. What do you think I should do? And I said, in order to save your sobriety and your sanity, haul your fanny down to detox and find out if you've taken anything. And so he did. And I went outside because I talk, as I say, I explain things to the God of my understanding. And when I get upset, I damn well get upset. And I went out under the tree out in front of my office. And I screamed at him and I said, God, this serious disease, this, wow, it is not fair that a power of alcoholism could be so intense they could reach out and snatch somebody like that. And I have disagreed with it hugely. And I explained to him, and I screamed and I yelled, and the people, as they frequently do on my street, so probably say, there's Carney, that weird shit's doing it again. You know, I'm out there in front of God and everybody, and I'm screaming to him. When I'm all done with my prayer, and I vented my anguish and my frustration and my sorrow, and I went back in the office, and by the time I hit the front steps, I had a huge pain in my chest. By the time I hit the second office, I was in serious trouble. By the time I hit the third office, I was falling down, and I fell down. They called the meds, and they rushed me to the hospital, San Jose Hospital, and I had a massive heart attack. Now, I haven't had cigarettes from that day to this, but that's not my story. That's just the beginning of the story. Okay, because it was extremely difficult for me to continue to smoke when you got oxygen coming out of you and they're poking things throughout you. And by the way, before I get it, I want you to know I'm still not willing to quit. Because by God, I'm stubborn. I'm going to hang on to that. I'm still not willing to quit. But this is a story that I offer, is that I was laying on the table and they were doing all sorts of obscene things to my body to try and fix me so that I could breathe and live. And what they said is, and I kept twinking in and out, and they kept saying that one of the things they said, we got one more try. If this doesn't work, we're going to lose him. And so everybody got ready, and they said, okay, it's time to go. And he started whatever the hell they were doing. And this is what I heard them say, oh, God, it's not working. Oh, Christ, we've lost him. Freedom is where I was at that time, because I have gone where a few men go. I said to myself when I went laying there, and they have told me I have died. And I said, by God, I am now going to know. I had a curious sense of excitement. Because I offer to you that if you believe in God, dying is but a geographic. Dying is but a geographic. And so I felt excited because I didn't know what was there, but I knew it was a sense of impending good was still with me. And then I took a second and I looked back at my life. And I said, oh, how grateful it is that I am, that everybody whom I love knows I love them, because I have told them, I have shared with them, I owe no one anything. I will miss them. Oh, but God, I've had a hell of a ride. And I call that a freedom that few men would know. Obviously, I didn't die. But the finish of that particular story goes this way. Is that they got me well enough to perform some surgery. It took about a week. And I'm in the hospital. And you were surrounded by the love of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Good God, the glorious people that loved me, that called to express their love. But it was the night before the surgery. I was going to get operated on very, very early in the morning. My wife was there, and I told her, honey, you don't have to stick around because they're going to give me something. I'm going to go to sleep, and they got to shave and do all the things they got to do to my body. Why don't you go home if you can, get a good night's sleep if you're going to come here in the morning. And so she did. And here I'm playing it cool because after all, I am in freedom. I know full well that I'm totally free. I owe no one anything. You see, one of the first things I did is I called my children in when I came back from this thing. When I'm laying in that hospital in recuperation, I called my kids and I said to each one of them, my children one at a time, and I have eight of them. I told them, if you have any unfinished business with me, get it done. Because I have none with you. And if you think I do, speak it and we will be finished. But I do not want to die and have you spend the rest of your life kicking yourself in the ass for the things that you have not told me or should have done. Because I spent too much time doing that. And one by one my children came to me and each one of them cleared the wreckage of their past. And here it is this night before the surgery. And I'm going through all of the anticipatory pain and anguish. And Peggy left, and I'm starting to walk around the corridor. And each step, I get more miserable, and I suddenly realize, oh my God, I'm going to die. The chances are great that I'm going to die. And I went into, oh me, poor me, horror. And I kept walking around that thing for about an hour until I suddenly realized the truth. To stop the self-deception, to stop it, is that I am free. You are free. I am free because this program Thomas promises me freedom. I owe no one anything. And when I found this, when I come to this discovery one more time, I recognize freedom is mine. You cannot take it away from me. Only I can take my freedom from me. And so I went to bed. I went to sleep just like a little baby, which is what you have given me since almost my first night. I'm eternally grateful for you. And one of the great lines in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that, as you can tell, I get excited about sobriety. I am so excited about it, it's hard to believe. I know that a young man came to me once, after a while, he said, John, he said, the first time I heard you, I knew something happened. I didn't know what it was, but I figured I was either married or buried. That's the way it happened to me. But one of the things I want to tell you that is, I would much prefer being sober and doing the things I am doing today than to have lived that way before. And one of the most precious lines in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous to me that I think is just absolutely glorious, and I can share it at any AA meeting, and if I went anywhere else, they'd think I'm nuts. And you do, maybe too, but that's your problem. I would much prefer to be a recovered alcoholic and an intelligent spearhead. It says in our big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, we are intelligent agents, spearheads of God's ever-advancing universe, God's ever-advancing creation. Can't you just imagine standing in a bar screaming that at the top of your lungs? But every one of us here is an intelligent agent. We are spearheads of God's ever-advancing creation. Love one another as I love you. Love one another in the same way that you love me, with the power that brought me to you when I couldn't find you. I love you, and I thank you, and have a good day.
Thank you, John. Thank you very much.